Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Shorty, bringing the best of my Times radio show, Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. You know how to do it. You can listen on the radio, DAB, on the smart speaker, on the app, or at Times.radio. You can do that, but we're bringing you the best bits. Couple of bits of housekeeping. Thank you for all of your messages for people who enjoyed the podcast yesterday, coming live from Westminster. One or two people thought we were not taking the pageantry seriously enough with a hat on a stick and all that, but lots of you seem to enjoy it, so thank you for that. Other bit of housekeeping, this is a message for Ben. Ben, your dad's been in touch. Ben Herneman, your dad's been in touch saying that listening to the Red Box podcast does not count as revision for the A-level politics exam you're about to sit. Apparently, that's what you like to claim, was slouching in headphones, clearly not writing an essay on classical liberalism. Ben, I think it probably does count. I mean, nothing that I say, but you know, lots of our guests are very smart. So thank you for listening anyway, Ben. But I hope, please don't blame me if the exam doesn't go well. And hello to everyone else who studied for exams as well, because I think lots of teachers and lecturers tell students to listen to the podcast. I'm not sure if we're Ofsted compliant, but anyway. Right, coming up on today's podcast, no PMQs today because of all the Queen's speech shenanigans. PMQs will be back next week, but instead we'll bring you Disunited Kingdom, political news from the four corners of the UK, England, Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland. So that's coming up in just a sec. But first, as ever, we kick off with our columnist panel. No Robert Crampton today, is offered a secret mission for the Times magazine. So today's columnists were Alice Thompson and Patrick Kidd.
The columnists on Times Radio.
Yes, it's that time of the morning we always speak to two of our favourite columnists. And on a Wednesday, it is usually Alibert, but Robert Thompson's been dispatched on some secret mission for the Times magazine. So we do have Alice Thompson. Morning, Alice.
Morning.
And the understudy, the Prince Charles to Robert Crampton's Queen, is Patrick Kidd. Morning, Patrick.
I should just have one of Robert's hats next to me. Probably a sort of flat tweed cap or something.
A flat tweed cap on the throne, on the throne next door. Nice to have you both. Nice to have you both. What did you make of it yesterday, Patrick? It was a slightly, I mean, even more scaled down. Is there a point at which there is just no pomp?
I don't want to lose the pomp. I love the pomp and the guilt complex that we have there. And I thought it was a really nice touch to have the crown on the cushion next to Prince Charles, and him not sitting in the throne, but on the understudy's bench. What I particularly liked, there was a picture of the mace being carried in the back of a car,
and it was sticking out the window.
And someone said it was like a dog going on holiday, sort of eagerly sticking its nose out.
I said on the show yesterday, it looked a bit like when, which I actually did this job last night, when you go to the dump and you can't quite fit everything in and shut the boot, so you need like the long bit sticking out.
There's
the window.
There's lots of it. There's the mace, the cap of maintenance, the sword of state.
The sword of state. I was learning in real time on the show yesterday. What did you make of it, Alice?
Well, I love all that. I have to say, I like the tights as well. I think, you know, men in tights look great. It's basically pantomime, isn't it? Which we've got the line, we don't get till Christmas. And who's behind you? And although Michael Gove did quite a good impression today, didn't he? I think he's been carrying it on.
What is Michael Gove doing? Go on, go on. There's another good excuse to play it again.
an emergency budget, a major capital letters, big news story.
Calm down.
He also, in another appearance on ITV's Good Morning Britain, he said the idea the Prime Minister should resign is bonkaroony. Is he all right, Alice?
Well, I'm getting a bit nervous about him, actually, aren't you? Because we haven't seen him for months. He's been tucked away. He hasn't been allowed out. And now that he is allowed out, I think he's a bit sort of, you know, all over the place, isn't he?
He's probably making the case of why he should be kept in. In terms of some of the policies in the Queen's speech yesterday, and the one that's made the front page of the Times, neighbours get the right to vote on housing plans. I feel like we've been around this block so many times, Alice. Well,
this is another Michael Gove problem, is that actually he doesn't want to force, and nor do the Tories, force everyone, especially in their own constituencies, to have all these houses, you know, forced onto them and to have all this building. So what he thinks he's done cleverly is to make the neighbours all decide. But actually, as we all know, the neighbours are never going to decide. We can't even decide who puts the bins out when or who's put the dog poo where. So I think the idea that everyone's going to agree on a street or in a village or a town is just completely bonkers, but does mean that instead of the government being blamed, it will be your next door neighbour.
The thing is, Patrick, I thought there's something I wonder whether sometimes it's a sort of Westminster bubble conservative groupthink thing that thinks that people don't want houses. I thought there's actually quite a lot of research that parents and grandparents are seized by this problem because they can see their kids haven't got anywhere to live.
Yeah, it's ludicrous. Someone 10 years younger than us trying to get on the market now would require an enormous... Well, they get help from their parents, of course. On the front page of the paper, Robert Jenrick is saying we're going to miss the target of 300,000 new homes a year by a country mile. And so suddenly allowing people to have a referendum on whether number 23 can have a greenhouse or something just seems to be fiddling.
Yeah, exactly. Because we were on the show yesterday, we were looking back on... The first time the Queen spoke at the State of the Parliament in 1952, where she talked about the importance of housing. And, you know, and back then, I was just trying to remember the numbers. It was something like 190,000 homes, I think, they built in 1952. And last year, it was something like 150. We're so far from the 300,000. We haven't done 300,000 in this country for years.
Yes. And also the French and the Germans seem to do it. I mean, that's what's extraordinary, is the British have such problems about building. And when we do, they're all totally identikit. I mean, I think more is that we just need better houses. And we, you know, the big housing companies, which they have said now, do need to start helping with the infrastructure. So if you're told that you're going to have your housing estate, which we've got in Devon just being built near us, actually, it's great and fantastic. But they're not building an extra school and they're not building any more, you know, doctors, GPs, surgeries, and there won't be any more green space. If they, you know, said, we'll do this, but we'll put in a park and a playground, people would be much happier.
And roads and trains, yeah, and things
actually,
like that.
Yeah. Councils have got those powers. And actually, if councils are worried that if they build a load of, you know, if they grant permission, that it might upset people, then blimey, they might be voted out of their district council. That isn't the answer to write all of that into the plan so that you know, people can say... Because actually, quite often, whenever there's these protests, you know, and then when the big estate is built, the world keeps turning. It turns out their kids don't have to move miles away for somewhere to live, and actually things are all right. The sort of the NIMBYism thing often dissipates once the things have been built.
I think it almost always dissipates, doesn't it, actually? And then you move on to the next one. And I think what you do need is to say is there are advantages to this. It's like the wind farms that no one realised. And actually, if you say you might get cheaper electricity if you don't mind having them, that there is always that incentive. If you say to people, actually, your village or town's going to look better, not worse, and have more, and, you know, is going to help you and your family and your children and the grandparents, that would be great. My problem is that a lot of them are too expensive. I look at them and think... Our latest one going up, they're sort of £500,000 for a very small three-bedroom house. I mean, how? You know, is anyone going to afford that, really?
Well, the Prince of Wales had his chance. He could have announced, slipped in a line, and once he's in, he could have said a £1 for every district council or something.
Yeah, you should have stuck that in, because then the government would have just had to go with it. They couldn't have said that the Prince Charles had lied. They'd have had to go on and make it work. That's what the government's doing. You've written about Keir Starmer's gambit, Alice, today.
Gambit. Well, I've written about how he should really be my ideal Prime Minister, because after we've had this sort of, you know, really high adrenaline Boris Johnson for the last 2 or 3 years, I think everyone's exhausted and just on edge and nervous and everything about him, whereas Keir is decent, diligent, clever, modest. You know when he turns up, he'll be wearing the right outfit, that he won't have hundreds of parking tickets, that he'll be on time. And that in many ways, he's got everything that he should have. He's measured, he's principled in so many ways, but actually there's just something missing. And that's what's so frustrating, that he hasn't quite got it. And even with the Partygate, he seems to be, you know, with Beergate, he's been given all the blame just after the local elections, when actually the Tories did very badly. It's now all about him and what he's got wrong, when in fact, you know, he may or may not have had, you know, a curry and a beer while he was working, and he may have just about finished work. But if you look at what was going on in Downing Street, it was just far worse, far more parties, far more karaoke, far more cakes, and somehow he's got embroiled in this sort of ridiculous discussion.
But isn't the problem, Patrick, if once you take the holier than now approach, you know, the thing about, but nobody's ever voted for Boris Johnson on the basis that he was a serial adherer to the rules. Whereas that was Keir Starmer's pitch. He's the former director of the public prosecution.
Yeah, and he is guilty of extreme sanctimony. I mean, calling for Rishi Sunak to resign, and indeed calling for Boris Johnson to resign when the investigation was launched, rather than allowing due process to carry on, I think now looks a bit like a mistake. That said, I am so bored of this story. I mean, how many days now has the Daily Met? 14 days or something? I am wondering whether it's going to come out that Lord Rothermere has actually sold the paper to the Taste of the Raj, and it's a way of promoting the restaurant. They're going to change the title to the Daily Mail, perhaps, just as subliminally. What day is it on the front?
Oh, actually, it's not on the front today.
We've moved on.
It's the first day.
We've got Wagatha Day One.
Oh, Wagatha. Oh, that's a good one.
But yeah, my favourite is when the Daily Mail says, as Beergate, it's day 12. There's only day 12 that you've put it on the front page for 12 days with no new information.
But actually, I think the thing for me is that I think Keir Starmer may be a bit like John Smith. And the problem is that he is sort of very... You know, he is, in many ways, is actually a safe pair of hands. But actually what you need is, you need someone like Wes Streeting, you need someone else coming up in the Labour Party. And if he does have to resign, I think the Tories may be in a more difficult position, because they may get someone from the Labour Party who's actually going to be better than Keir Starmer. And then they'll really, you know, think, God, why did we ever get ourselves into getting rid of Keir when we've got someone worse?
It has enabled some of the cabinet members who don't think things through, though, to say things that have consequences. So Nadine Dorries saying that Keir Starmer must resign if he had a party, not realising the consequence of that is Boris Johnson surely has to resign.
Whoa. I won't have anything said against Nadine Dorries. I'm not having you come on here and suggest that she might not have thought something through fully.
I did love your mate Andrew Bridgen as well, suggesting that we should have a united national police force, that the Met should investigate Durham affairs.
I'm going to phone my lawyers about the suggestion that you suggesting that Andrew Bridgen is my mate. I did see him actually down from a distance down at College Green yesterday, but for some reason he didn't come over and say hello. I don't know why. Let's talk about Eurovision. Are you excited by Eurovision, Patrick?
I am, actually. I love the sort of the high campness of it all. That's on this weekend. And, of course, this is going to be a politically charged one, because everyone is expecting that Ukraine, who have a fairly mediocre song, will win because of the sympathy vote. And of course, in the past, we've seen at Eurovision, voting is done on political lines. Greece always votes for Cyprus and vice versa. But, you know, now everyone's going to vote for Ukraine because they don't like Russia. This isn't, however, the first time that politics has got involved in Eurovision. I can tell you. In 1974, the Italian song, which was called Si, a word they said 16 times, was banned from Italian radio because they had a referendum on, and they thought it was subliminal affecting.
Oh, really?
But having it saying CCC. And the same year, Portugal, their winning entry, was used as the signal for a coup to start against the government.
Wow.
When the Eurovision number was played over the radio.
That was it.
And it wasn't boom, bang, a bang. But
only because Patrick is so obsessed by the Eurovision, I have now listened to the Ukrainian song, and actually I think he's dissing it. I think it's actually quite good. And you know, you can't not vote for them when they've come out of a war and they're going straight back into a war and they've been looking after orphans. I mean, Patrick, I think you're too hard-hearted.
Maybe I am, but it's no Katrina and the Waves. But if they win with Stefania, then they get to host it next year. So next
Good.
Year in Mariupol.
Yes. I think that's perfect, don't you think? When we can all go. And then actually, I think that's exactly what the Eurovision is meant for. I think it's ideal, isn't it?
So that's the second big media event of the week, Alice, because the big media event of the week, of course, is your book launch tonight.
Of course. And of course, I hope you're coming. And have you seen, I sent you the outfit I want you to wear. It's the Jean Paul Gaultier has done a naked...
Oh, is that the one you think that I'm going to wear?
Yeah, and I'm not wearing it, Patrick. You're all going to wear it, and so are you, Matt, I'm afraid.
It's a naked man... no, there's naked woman.
It looks like a naked woman.
It's a naked woman.
It's
you're
in
right.
Selfridges. It costs a fortune. I'm
and
afraid.
it's a sort of body, all in one body stocking with a photo of a naked woman sort of on it. I'm not sure about wearing it. So, presumably, are you not in the studio because you're at home, sort of rustling up the Volavods?
Well, I should be, yes, exactly. Although, actually, the Times is very kindly doing that for us. I think all of you are, actually. So I hope you bought some things in.
Well, make sure you put the wine on to warm now.
Yeah, start warming the wine.
Yes, yes.
Just the wine.
Obviously, you've never seen the view from the Times either because you've never been into the office, so you won't know. It'll be all original and new for you.
Who?
Patrick. For you, both of you, I think.
We're sitting here on the 14th.
Yeah, we're the ones here. We can see out of the window. We're the ones.
It's very different on the 17th. Actually.
I've been up to the 17th floor, buddy. Anyway, it's going to be lovely. Is it going to be a big bash or is it exclusive?
I think it's quite exclusive. We may only say the book is called What I Wish I'd Known When I Was Young.
Which is the spin-off from your excellent podcast and Times Radio series, Passing Perfect.
Exactly. So it's going to be lots of our interviewees, although I'm not sure how many of them are going to come because it's probably the ones that like being interviewed by us because Rachel and Sylvester and I have done all the interviews that we have ever done in the last 30 years, I think, which makes me quite old.
Not at all. Well, you must have started when you were, what, 10?
Alice Thompson and Patrick Kiddo, and of course you can read them both in the Times every week. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next is Dish United Kingdom.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Red Box Podcast now. It's time for this.
From Land's End to John O'Groats, St David's to Southend-on-Sea, and Belfast to Bognor Regis. England, Wales, Scotland, Northern Ireland. This is Disunited Kingdom on Times Radio.
Yeah, it's that time of the week when we get out and about away from the Westminster bubble to find out what's really going on in the four corners of the UK. Coming up, we'll of course do our fun story competition to find out the most fun part of the UK. But first, let's introduce the panel. Flying the flag for Northern Ireland today, Amanda Ferguson is a journalist in Belfast. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Matt. There's a lot happening here today, so we could probably take up the whole show with what's happening in Northern Ireland. But
I'm aware. You may well win the competition for the most news. In Scotland, political reporter with the Scottish Sun is Dan Vivas. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Matt. How's it going?
Very good. Very good. Nice to have you with us. Reporter at Wales Online is Liz Perkins. Welcome back, Liz.
Hi there. How are you?
Very good. Very good. And we go to Manchester, flying the flag for England Day. Correspondent of Manchester Evening News, Helena Vesti. Hi, Helena.
Hi. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Go on then, Amanda. Kick us off. Don't eat up the whole half hour. What's going on in... not for the first time, we asked. What the hell is going on in Northern Ireland?
Well, we don't have government at the moment. We know that the election results came through at the weekend and that Sinn Féin emerged as the largest party. So that's a big deal in Northern Ireland because it's the first time an Irish Republican who's committed to the reunification of Ireland holds that very top position. The DUP came second, and there's a bit of an issue now about whether or not the parties are going to meet on Friday. Will the DUP participate in reforming the new assembly? So far, they've said no to that. Another big story coming out of the election is the sort of emergence and the surge in support for the Cross Community Alliance Party. But all eyes are kind of on the DUP at the moment because it's looking for movement on the Brexit protocol before it reforms power sharing. So all of the other parties are accusing it of holding Northern Ireland to ransom, and it's a pretty sort of changing atmosphere in this part of the world at the moment. We're not quite sure what's going to happen next, but we do know that we've got 90 new MLAs elected, and it could be some time before we actually get government up and running. So I'm sure the public will have something to say regarding the cost of living crisis and all of the issues that we're exercising them ahead of them casting their votes.
Amanda, I was quite struck yesterday. I spoke to Sir Geoffrey Donaldson, the leader of the DUP, and tried to get out of him what exactly it is that he thinks would work. And I'll be honest, I wasn't much the wiser afterwards, because he appeared to be essentially be suggesting a border between Ireland and Northern Ireland. Do you think, are the DUP using the protocol as an excuse not to go in and play second fiddle to Sinn Féin, rather than having any expectation that it could be sorted out to their satisfaction?
Well, the DUP say they're Democrats and that they're devolutionists and they want to get back to government. But certainly it's a complicating factor that they're not sort of in the top position anymore. But I think, you know, the office of First Minister in Northern Ireland is a joint office. Deputy doesn't mean subordinate. You know, if they were named joint First Ministers, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation. But I think that one of the key things that the DUP will be looking out for movement wise regards the protocol is for the goods that are moving from Britain to Northern Ireland. If they're staying within Northern Ireland, they don't want any of those to be subject to checks. So maybe if they could get a win on that, it could move things along a little bit. Certainly, there's sort of suspicion that the DUP is unhappy that it will be taking that second place. But the DUP leader did say yesterday evening that if the issues around the protocol are resolved to his satisfaction, that he would be nominating ministers. So we'll have to wait and see what happens. But certainly, it's not the first and the last time that there's been a sort of complicated picture about governance in Northern Ireland. So I think the story has a way to go yet.
Go on then. What's your chances? When do you think we might see Stormont sitting again?
Well, they do have up to 6 months if they choose to take that. But the next movement will be on Friday at midday, because that's supposed to be the first meeting of the Assembly. That's due to be when the Speaker's nominated this morning. The DUP indicated that it hasn't made a decision on whether it's going to participate in that. So if you don't nominate a Speaker, you don't pass go and you don't have a shadow Assembly. So that's causing outrage amongst the other political parties in Northern Ireland at the moment, who are saying they want to get back to work, that it's disgraceful that the Assembly would be held up by an issue isn't in the DUP's gift to fix, that it's up to the UK government and the EU to fix what happens next with the protocol. But depending on who you speak to and which parts of the government you're hearing from and which parts of the Conservative Party you're hearing from, there could be movement, there could be unilateral action, things could just continue to rumble on. So after our last collapse in 2017 to 2020, one of the pieces of legislation that was put in place was to give a 6 month breathing space to the parties. But you know, we still don't know yet on Friday if we're even going to get past the first hurdle of getting a Speaker in place so that a shadow Assembly could operate in the absence of fully functioning government.
But that's the picture of it when it comes to the protocol in the Assembly sitting. In terms of the Queen's speech yesterday, I was going to sort of bounce around and ask everyone for the reaction to Queen's speech, but what was there in it, what was in there for Northern Ireland? What's particularly caught your eye?
One of the big things was regarding the sort of proposals around prosecutions for troubles related crimes. There seems to have been a change around now where instead of a blanket amnesty, there could be prosecutions conditional on cooperation with a new truth recovery investigation. And we're going to have to wait to see what's included in the Northern Ireland Troubles and Reconciliation Bill. The government's aim, they say, is to maximise information recovery and promote reconciliation, but a lot of victims groups have said that, you know, it's an example that lives in Northern Ireland don't matter as they do in other parts of the UK. You know, one of the examples from the Way of Trauma Centre, which supports victims of the conflict in Northern Ireland, was sort of the juxtaposition between the murder of a young man called John Molloy in North Belfast and the murder of Stephen Lawrence in England. You know, what they're saying is with this new proposal from the UK government, someone could come forward and say that they had murdered John Molloy because he was a Catholic and it was sectarian. So how is that any different from you would expect justice in the case of a racist killing and so on? So it's a very emotive issue here. And there's a while to go on that yet. The other issue that popped up is around the Irish language legislation, around the cultural package that the UK government was going to bring forward because the Stormont Assembly hadn't been able to agree to because of objections from some within the unionist community. So it was around accommodating cultural difference and enhancing and developing both the Irish language and the Ulster Scots British tradition in Northern Ireland. So very different issues, but certainly the Irish language community are wondering and waiting why it's taken so long.
Blimey, O'Reilly's. That's plenty there for Mamanta in Northern Ireland. Let's go to Scotland now then. Dan, what were your main takeaways from the Queen's speech from a Scottish perspective?
Well, there were lots of complaints, and I guess that's not atypical from the Scottish government and the SNP. I mean, the main complaint seems to be a lack of any real direct action on cost of living. That seems to have really rubbed people up along the wrong way. And I suppose, you know, you have this schism now, and it's not just a Scottish UK government thing, but it's possibly a left-right thing, possibly a sort of fiscal conservative against liberal thing, where, you know, the Tories are saying we shouldn't be spending any more money right now because that will mean borrowing because we need to keep inflationary pressures down. But, you know, the Scottish government and others are saying actually these inflationary pressures are really hurting now, so we need action now. And that seems to be the sticking point that people can't get past.
And I suppose because of devolution and so on, the big day in Scotland is when the First Minister sets out her legislative programme, but with slightly less pomp and shiny gold things sticking out of the windows of cars.
Yes, that's not really our style to have the big golden thrones. I think it's a shame. I think it would be quite a good laugh. But we do sometimes have the Queen pop along for the state opening of Parliament and things like that. But no, it doesn't have the same pomp and ceremony. But actually, mentioning the monarchy, I thought it was interesting. Obviously, there's this convention that the monarchs and the Queen don't weigh in on political issues directly in terms of making direct statements, and there was a line in the Queen's speech yesterday about protecting the integrity of the United Kingdom, and there was a few people who got a bit upset by that because they said it was putting a direct political reference into Charles's mouth, which
I mean that is the whole speech. I mean, similarly, I don't know, Prince Charles agree with selling off Channel 4? Or, you know, that is the nature of the speech. It's written by the government and it's not, you know, it's not supposed to be his or the Queen's view.
Indeed, yeah. But you'll remember the big furore back in 2014 when the Queen gave her, you know, not direct support for the union, but certainly gave that impression that she didn't want to see a yes vote. And that's never been forgotten by nationalists in Scotland, that's for sure.
It is amazing that, because wasn't it something she said, something like she hoped that people would think very carefully? And this is interpreted as Queen backs no.
Yeah, in Queen lingo, that was bringing out the Union Jack bunting. And
yeah, it was quite a moment, that. So that's a picture in Scotland. What about in Wales, Liz Perkins? What's the Welsh perspective on the Queen's speech?
I was going to say, I can be quite quick on this one. Clearly, it was kind of interesting to see the Prince of Wales reading the Queen's speech. And a lot of it wasn't relevant to Wales because obviously so much of it has been devolved. So what is interesting to us is that in terms of the Australia and New Zealand bill, the farmers are in uproar about it. Clearly, they've had to suffer as a consequence of Brexit. And having these trade deals should be good news, but the sad reality for them is that they feel that they won't be able to charge as much for their products and they're going to suffer as a consequence. And they're suggesting it's going to enshrine in fairness in trade for them. I mean, it was referred to earlier on in the news about the fact that, you know, there's going to be a crackdown on these guerrilla type protests. And there's a sense that too that other people might suffer as a consequence of that because they want to be able to protest on legitimate issues without doing, you know, employing those tactics. So clearly there was, you know, concern around that as well.
Again, when you have the Welsh equivalent of the state opening of Parliament in Cardiff, how does it rate on the pomp scale?
I think we do better on pomp, though, don't we? Because we do actually invite the Queen and we have, you know, members of the royal family coming there and all the rest of it. And in spite of opposition from, you know, nationalists, even, you know, sometimes they tend to behave. Sometimes you have people calling the Queen Mrs. Windsor. You just don't know what's going to happen. Yes, it's caused controversy in the past with some, but it is a bit more, you know, you've got a bit more celebration and pomp, like you say, than Scotland, I think.
Very good. So on the pomp scale, we ought to try to work out who does the most. I mean, probably England does do the most pomp, but in terms of the substance, Helena from the Manchester Evening News, what's been the reaction? I mean, obviously lots of talk about Red Wall, the North, the South, what the government's doing, levelling up, and all of that. What's the picture in Manchester? Response to the Queen's speech.
I think the response to the Queen's speech in Manchester is perhaps best put as mixed at best. I mean, there was a great deal, I think, that involved Manchester and the wider North within that speech. The headline has to be levelling up. That's been a cornerstone of Boris Johnson's agenda, and it's finally made the statute book. The Levelling Up and Regeneration Bill has been unveiled finally. And that follows Michael Gove's 300-page white paper, which was published earlier this year. And certainly, I think at the time, that document left a lot to be desired, not least in the health sort of category, which is what I cover, health inequalities, as insofar as they're informed by economic inequalities in the North, were really barely mentioned. And certainly in health and among many other topics, there have been so many questions about what levelling up will actually look like, and if the promises that Boris Johnson has made, and he's made really quite large scale promises, will be fulfilled in the end, and what really is that going to look like on the ground in towns which are seeing their high streets shutting, and culturally they're not quite as robust as they were pre-austerity. And I think that actually raises a really key point that I've seen discussed in the wake of the Queen's speech. There's a lot of debate about whether levelling up, particularly through the grants that it provides, will just be building back lost capacity that occurred under austerity. Data from independent think tanks show that many northern towns were disproportionately affected by austerity. So will they get the same support to build back that level of council support pre-austerity and then beyond that? Because that would be the definition of levelling up. It would be building back to what was there before and then some. But will we just see building back to what was there before? I think that's a big question that's sort of been left open-ended. Equally, I think one thing that was really good to see for everybody in Manchester in the Queen's speech was, after much delay, the inclusion of Martin's Law, which was campaigned for by Fegan Murray, who's the mother of Martin, who lost his life in the Manchester Arena bombing, and also Brendan Cox, who's the husband of the murdered MP Joe Cox. And Martin's Law, which is also known as the Draft Protect Duty Bill, establishes a new framework for public venues, which previously weren't required to enact free advice that they got from specialist counter-terrorism measures, advisors rather. And now this bill means that these kinds of venues will actually have to have a plan in place on how to deal with such an incident.
So this is a bit like they already had a responsibility to sort of have a fire plan if a fire broke out. And
exactly.
Now they've got to have one. So if there were to be a serious terror incident, that large venues do have a plan to try and avoid some of the issues that arose with the Manchester attack.
Yeah, and I think the key part of that, again, is mitigation as well. What happens? What's the immediate plan if something like that should unfold? And a lot of that is taken from the learnings of the arena inquiry and naturally quite a painful memory for the city. So I think it's a real positive to see that it's been included in the Queen's speech. Perhaps somewhere in between, both a positive and a negative, I think, for Manchester and the North is the abolishment of no-fault evictions, which is now under the Renters Reform Bill. And that has been a chief cause of evictions in Manchester. And this city, Lord knows, has quite an acute problem with homelessness. I think it's unavoidable. The Greater Manchester Mayor Andy Burnham has spoken extensively about that and has really made it a key part of his time as the leader of the city. So I think that is a real positive step towards reducing those kinds of evictions, but needless to say, I think that the city still has a long way to go on how it can deal with its homelessness population. And that links right back into levelling up and getting that funding for our cities up here.
Oh, that's the that's a good old mixed picture of the response to the Queen's speech. So I'm glad we've cleared all of that up. We've done the political news, which is fine and interesting, but this is the most important bit. This is the fun story competition. As things stand, we've been doing this since the beginning of the year. Scotland in the lead with 38 points. Northern Ireland and Wales both tied on 35, and England currently in last place with 32 points. Let's start with England then today. Helena Vesti, correspondent for Manchester Evening News. What's your fun story from Manchester?
Our fun story from Manchester is Alex Zinchenko, who is a Manchester City player. And he's been very vocal in support of his home country, which is currently racked by war, which is Ukraine. And we've seen a number of touching moments involving this player, whether it was standing ovation at Goodison Park or him being handed the captain's armband during an FA Cup match against Peterborough. And now he's sort of taken a little 10-year-old boy under his wing. And this 10-year-old had to flee his home in Ukraine along with his family because of the war. And he's received a special gift from the Ukrainian player, and that's that he's been taken to Manchester City to have a visit and meet the player. And in a nice social media post, the football player said, 75 days ago, this boy dreamed of becoming a football player and trained carefree with his team. And I think that just shows how quickly life has been immensely upended for yeah. millions of families, and just shows how these youngsters losing their childhoods is just such a deep tragedy. But it is a really good example, a very thoughtful and kind gesture from here in Manchester, I think.
It's a nice story. It's going to be hard to beat. But we've got another, is a football story in Scotland. Football story in Scotland as well, Dan?
Yes, it is. I live in Glasgow, so about 50% of the city is extremely excited about next Wednesday when Rangers play in the Europa League final. It's the first time there's been a Scottish team in a European final since 2008. I don't think we've won one since like the 1980s. And obviously, as usual with these things, lots of Rangers fans are desperate to get over there. One of the more innovative means of trying to get there that we discovered is a hot air balloon. The Rangers fans have been asking a hot air balloon company if they can rent the hot air balloon to fly over to Seville for the match against Frankfurt. There's a few bits of this that I love. The first one is that the hot air balloon firm put out a message yesterday just saying, okay, we've received messages from about three different people asking about balloon flights over the channel to France. We can confirm we do not fly over the channel. If this is a joke, it's a funny one. And I can guarantee it wasn't a joke.
So is this because there aren't flights?
Well, there are flights, but obviously, as ever with these things, the flights are going up and up and up, and demand's very, very high. So people are trying to find cheap ways of getting over. But the funniest part of the story for me is that the British Balloon and Airship Club put out a statement on this. And the first thing they said is that if anyone wanted to go by hot air balloon to Spain, they should have set off in middle of March, because that's how long it would take to fly there. So I don't think anyone's going to get to Seville by balloon in time for May 18th.
That's very good. Right, a non-football story now. What have you got for us in Wales, Liz Perkins?
I've got rat-eating snakes for you.
This is the sort of story we don't have enough of on Times Radio. Go on then. Rat-eating snakes in Colwyn Bay.
In Colwyn Bay, the Escalapian rat snake is on the loose. And ironically, they actually disappeared from the zoo about 50 odd years ago. And now they're roaming around the countryside. We've even got footage of the snake going across the road. It's just, well, it's worth watching anyway. It's
I can see it. I can see it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just unbelievable. You don't really expect this. And they've actually spread from North Wales to Bridgend as well. And it was Robert Jackson, the founder of the Welsh Mountain Zoo, who brought these reptiles in from Italy. And then they started seeing these baby snakes sort of disappearing in about the 1970s. And yeah, they've just gone everywhere. So you can't imagine. I mean, some experts are really excited because years ago they used to be in Britain and now, you know, they really are making a comeback. So if you've got lots of rats in your garden, you probably would like these snakes to suddenly arrive, wouldn't you? But for the rest of us, I don't think I'd want one.
Perhaps not. Yeah, but right. Excellent. Very good. And finally, your story from Northern Ireland, Amanda.
Yes, we've got a TikTok fame for a Belfast pensioner after his dance moves go viral. So 85-year-old Jim Jordan's slick dance moves have made him a TikTok star. A member of staff at Brooklyn's care home in Dunmurry told Belfast Live that JJ, as he's known, is a real character and that all the staff love him. In his younger years, he was a British Empire Games silver medalist. He won a range of other medals, well known by the boxing community throughout Ireland. So he's retained his light-footed boxing moves and that's helped his dance moves. So he loves dancing and is reveling in his newfound fame.
Oh, this is a tough week. I think it's going to be very hard to not give the most points to the Ukrainian child refugee being taken to Man United training. That's very good. So we'll give 4 points to that. So 4 points to England. I do like the hot air balloon. I like the ingenuity of Rangers fans. Let's give them 3 points. 2 points to the TikTok sensation. And the only reason I'm giving only 1 point to the rat-eating six-foot snakes is that I don't think they should be encouraged. We don't want any other snakes escaping from zoos. So we'll give them 1 point, which I think Scotland's still in the lead. If anything, it's pulled... Maybe I should... No, I can't change that now. The points have been awarded. They're locked in now. Thank you very much, as ever, for your fun stories, but also talking us through the politics of the four corners of the UK. That was Disunited Kingdom. Helena Vesti, correspondent of the Manchester Evening News. Liz Perkins, reporter at Wales Online. Dan Vivers is a political reporter at the Scottish Sun. And Amanda Ferguson, a journalist in Belfast. Thank you to you all. Particularly thank you to Amanda, as she's pointed out on Twitter. There's so much going on in Northern Ireland. It ate up half of the item. That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. And we bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not wait and review us wherever you get your podcasts from.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no,
I don't know,
yes.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.